Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
You cannot intimidate the Tampa Bay Rays. They're not afraid. They're not afraid of anybody or anything. I mean, no, they do not match up with Houston on paper. Pretty much nobody does. But the Rays just don't give a damn. Couldn't give a damn that Houston's got that killer lineup. Or a clubhouse of killers. Or a rotation stacked with Cy Young candidates. Doesn't matter to the Rays. And it didn't matter to the Rays that Houston jumped on them early on to take a 2-0 series lead. Thanks to dominant performances by their Cy Young candidates, Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole. Didn't matter then, because the Rays just do not back down. Down 2-0, they rough up Zach Greinke in Game 3. At that point, Houston knows they're in a fist fight. So they respond, and they go back to Verlander on short rest in Game 4. Houston rolls out the best starter in baseball. Tampa responds without a starter. They go with Diego Castillo as their opener. And he opened the hell out of that game by giving up a leadoff single and then striking out Michael Brantley, Jose Altuve, and Alex Bregman in order. Well, that brought the Dome to life, right? Then Tommy Pham nearly tore it down when he did this in the bottom of the first.
The 2-2 pitch. Launched toward the left. Back at it is Brantley. He looks up. It's 1-0 Rays! Tommy Pham homers here. Two batters in, and the Rays take a 1-0 lead. Here on the bottom of the first.
Rays radio. Second batter of the game. First run of the night. A few batters later, it's 3-0. The drop was peaking. Like, Verlander did not look like his normal self. Not even close. I mean, don't get me wrong. He's out there busting his ass, taking the ball in short notice. But he's grinding. That was not vintage Verlander. Not by a long shot. But he was finding a way to keep Houston in the game. The problem for Houston, they averaged nearly 6 runs per game in the regular season, and their bats never got going. And that 3-0 lead for Tampa felt like it was 10-0. Then in the top of the fourth, Houston finally does get something going. Altuve leads off the single, and then with one out, Yordan Alvarez comes to the plate. Alvy, if you don't mind, can you roll it for me?
Yarbrough on top. Breathes out and throws. Line drive to the gap, right center. On the move, Kiermaier can't get it. It short hops the wall. Plays the caramel, 2-2 to third is being waved. Adames with a relay. Here's the throw. Darno's got it. He is out at home plate.
Holy crap. Textbook. That was amazing. Kevin Kiermaier to Willy Adames to Travis Darno. A laser off the bat, a laser from center, and a laser on the relay throw. Straight laser show all around. Textbook. Better yet, that was an instructional video. The instructional video that gets results. The GOAT of defensive drills. Professional scout and instructor Tom Emanski would be proud. We're talking arm strength, quickness, agility, body control. If I didn't know any better, I would say those were the same techniques that produced Baseball World's back-to-back AAU national titles. I mean, I saw that play last night. I was about to break out my credit card for the 1-800-800 number. I had my credit card at the ready. That was not just a run-saving play. That was a game-changing play. A series-changing play. Houston scores right there. Then it's 3-1. They've got a runner on. Everything is different. Instead, Altuve gets nailed at the plate. And then, in the bottom of the inning, who do you think comes up first? Of course, Willy Adames. The oldest cliche in the book is a player makes a huge play defensively and then immediately chases that with a huge knock at the plate to lead off the next inning. Except it's not a cliche. Now it's science.
Out of the windup, the veteran right-hander deals. There's a high drive deep in the air, left center field. Brantley turns and looks. It's gone! Home run! Willy Adames has homered again, and the Rays have a 4-0 lead.
421 feet later. 4-0 Rays. You think that fourth inning had anything to do with the outcome of that game? You save at least one run in the top, then you knock one out in the bottom, an enormous swing in that game. And ultimately, it led to Verlander leaving that game. And the way Tampa is using its bullpen again, that 4-0 lead may as well have been 14-0. Even when Houston made good contact, it was right at somebody. Again, That was a 3 or 4 run game for most of the night that still felt like Tampa Bay was lapping them. Houston could not get anything going. And then in the ninth, Tampa turns it over to their Cy Young Award winner, Blake Snell, to make his first relief appearance ever. I mean, essentially, this is what the Rays do, right? Anything and everything they can to exhaust their resources to find a way to get it done. And then he did this.
Snell ready with the runners leading at second and third. The 1-2. Swinging a line drive back up the middle. Right there is Wendell. He has it. Throws the first. Rays win. Rays win. Rays win. They beat the Astros by a score of 4-1. Have evened up this series at 2 games apiece. And Houston, we're on our way back.
Man, they are tough as hell. They are so tough. Game 5, Houston, tomorrow night. One game to decide it all. Just don't come around Kevin Kiermaier with that David and Goliath bullcrap. He's not having it.
People mentioned David and Goliath to me and some of the other guys before the series, and I just had to cut them off before they even went on with that because I don't want to hear that. I know Houston is probably better on paper and all that, but anything can happen when you step on the field at the same time.
He's right. Nothing about this says David v. Goliath. The Rays won 96 games. Sure, they handle their pitching differently, but they're nasty. And in this series, when Verlander and Cole have not been on the mound in Houston, Tampa Bay has been the bully. In fact, they've dominated. Houston, on the other hand, has struggled. Overall, you can make the argument that they've pretty much been outplayed. But it may not matter because they are coming back home and they're putting Cole on the mound to win the series. Now, if you want to second guess AJ Hinch for starting JV on short rest, you can. He knows you probably will. And he would probably tell you that Wade Miley was not an awesome option. And neither was running out a rookie in game 4 on the road. He'd also tell you if you've got the 2 Cy Young Award favorites, you may as well use them. Again, the issue last night was not so much Verlander not being Verlander, not even Verlander going on short notice, or short rest, I should say. It was the Astros hitters not being the Astros hitters, and the Rays pitchers definitely being the Rays pitchers. So, it all comes down to this. Tomorrow night, Game 5, Tyler Glasnow and Gerrit Cole. Nobody knows what's going to happen, except I know this. Tampa Bay will not be afraid. Man, they're a beauty. League's lowest payroll. Can't get fans in the seats. Talk of splitting games with Montreal. Fly to Oakland for a wild card game. A bunch of relievers pushing this series to a winner-take-all versus a special Stros team. I'm not sure a team has ever embodied not dead, can't quit better than the 2019 Rays. Vampires, y'all. Absolute vampires. So let's see if they can handle the high 90s stake that Cole is going to be running through their heart tomorrow. Can't wait.
Can't wait.
But let me ask you this before I go to break. Let me ask you one last thing because nobody else will. Clear my voice for this. Montreal, how y'all living? I want to hear from a seam head in Granby. Do I have a Rays fan in Pierreville? I don't care if you have Rogers Wireless or Bell Mobility. Find yourself a damn bar or three and give me a call now. Can you hear me, Roxton Falls? Van Cleek Hill, how you like your chances in Houston for Game 5? Who on the Trans-Canada Highway wants to talk Rays baseball? If not now, when, Sherbrooke? Is this on? Is it on, Canada? Quebec City, I've been to your town. It's beautiful. Great countryside. I drove through there once. Quebec City, is this your team? Do I have an affiliate in Drummondville? If not, why not? Victoriaville, I'm talking to you. It's taking a year off my life every time I do this. Are you planning the parade route in St. Catherine on St. Catherine Street? Montreal, they're your Rays. Warren Cromartie, Ellis Valentine, Steve Rogers. Any of you? Quick question for you. Why does men's health called the Peloton bike, quote, the best cardio machine on the planet, end quote. I'll tell you why. Because it is, straight up. Let me give you some facts. Let me break this down for you. Like, you can't find a workout that keeps you engaged, right? Well, Peloton is an immersive cardio experience with real-time features that will always keep you coming back. I have one. I jumped on that thing for the first time. I have not gotten off since. I'm addicted. I love everything about my Peloton. Literally everything. I love its size. It's compact. I've actually moved it around. I had it in my home gym, then I moved it into my home office. It's almost like a piece of furniture. It looks so good. Also, I love the value. One subscription is all you need to get unlimited classes for the entire family. There is no commute. There are no reservations. Thousands and thousands of rides that you can take either live or on demand anytime you want, all for less than the cost of a studio class. The Peloton literally will pay for itself. And right now, we have a great offer for you, a limited time offer. Get $100 off accessories when you purchase the Peloton bike. You'll get an amazing cardio workout from your home. Go to onepeloton.com and then use the promo code Rome and get started. Go to onepeloton.com, use the promo code Rome and get started. And let me remind you, I bought my Peloton myself long before we became partners on this program. I love it. It is one of the greatest investments I have ever made. Peloton. Adrian Amos is my guest. Adrian, good to have you on. How are you?
Good, man. How you doing?
Good, good. Yeah, it's good to have you on. Listen, I know you've already shifted to focusing on Detroit, but if you could, can you take me back to last week for a moment? The team was coming off that tough loss against Philadelphia, getting ready for a trip to Dallas. What was the mood and the mindset among the players going into that game?
Just rebound onto the next week. Get into Dallas and stop that run game. We did it for the most part for three quarters. Was great on defense, and then we let them creep back in at the end of the game. But we finished strong, and that's the big thing. Win the game.
You finished strong, and you started strong. You jumped on them and went out to a 31-3 lead. Did that feel more like the Packer football and the Packer defense that you had been expecting?
Oh yeah, for sure. We've been playing great for the majority of the season. We have a couple mistakes here and there, but for the most part, we've been getting after the ball. We've been getting after quarterbacks. We've been getting after it in coverage. So when we're playing great defense, that's the brand of ball that we focusing on.
Adrian Amos is joining us. From the outside, it seems like that defense feeds off one another. Like, what's it like being in the secondary when you've got Preston Smith and Za'Darius Smith getting after the quarterback the way they have been?
Oh, it's great, when you can have that rush and then the back end, working together. We causing coverage sacks, and they getting at the quarterback and making them throw, passes that they don't intend to make, making them rush them throws or loft one up, for us to, have one of those easy interceptions.
Hey, you're one of a number of new faces on that defense this year, but it seems like guys have gotten on the same page pretty quickly. A few weeks into the season, how would you describe the identity of this defense, and then how high is the ceiling for this group?
Oh, I feel like we're getting better every day. As you said, we're growing, learning each other more and more. It made it a little bit easier that we have a lot of, great personalities in the locker room. A lot of guys, feed off of one another. We hang out, off the field. We've already had, a lot of events already this year where we're just getting together as a defense and talking. I feel like football is a lot more fun when you like one another.
Adrian, what about that? Like, whenever I hear that stuff, it always seems like, I'm not saying that it's not true, but it seems like you try to manufacture that stuff off the field and it doesn't really translate, but clearly it does. How does bonding off the field help you guys when it really matters on the field?
It's just a matter of trust, and if somebody getting on to you, holding you accountable, it's a lot easier when you actually like that person. When a person getting on you, it's out of love. It's not out of, nobody's trying to, lowball you or anything like that. So I think it's big when holding each other accountable when things go bad and go wrong within a game.
Adrian Amos is joining us. That makes sense to me. So as long as we're talking about the identity of the defense, you've said the team's celebrations on turnovers only deserve a grade of about a C so far.
Yeah.
What are you looking for from the fellas to get that grade up to an A?
Oh, man, we just have, come up with more stuff. But that's going to come with more plays we make. The more plays we make, the more celebrations we can come up with, and a lot more fun we're going to have. So, you know, we're going, you know, when we have off time in practice, we're not going to take practice time and do that. But when we have some, you know, off time, we're going to think of a couple of things to, you know, give a better show.
Good. All right, so the team made it very clear in the offseason you were a priority for them because of your ability, because of your football IQ, and because of your accountability. They made it very clear they wanted you to come in. They loved you. What made Green Bay feel like the right spot, though, for you?
Those things, you know, they wanted me. You know, it's an opportunity to come and be in a defense where I can be versatile. I can do multiple things, you know, to help the team. You know, just to be able to show my skill set, and then a lot of guys that, you know, they've brought in, and then the characteristics of this team, and then we have a great, you know, generational quarterback that you know, can get it done on that side as well. So I just feel like the sky's the limit for this team. We just have to, you know, keep plugging away one game at a time.
Generational quarterback's the best way to put that. As somebody who went up against Aaron Rodgers over the years, what's it like having him as your quarterback? And maybe are there things you've learned about him now as a quarterback that maybe you didn't even know before you arrived?
Man, you know, I always knew, you know, he's a great quarterback. Just coming in, I think my first start ever was against Aaron. And, you know, it's just, you know, you just see the difference between him and other quarterbacks as far as the throws that, you know, he's able to make, how smart he is too. But the thing that I learned just being here is just his more of his personality. You know, I know sometimes he, you know, he seems like shy or shut off with the media, but, you know, around the locker room, he's just like one of the other guys. He's, you know, talking and joking with everybody. One of the first players that greeted me when I came into the building was him. You know, he came and said, "Welcome to the team," and everything. So that's what I, you know, would say I learned about him that I didn't know before I got here.
Adrian Amos is joining us, Green Bay Packers safety. You mentioned that was your first start. Look, as I said, you're a guy who's known for a football IQ. You're a guy who's known as somebody who spends a lot of time in the dark room putting the time in. But what was it like making your first NFL start against a generational quarterback?
It was a great opportunity. It was like that was my first, you know, reality. I'm in the NFL now, you know, playing against a guy like that. And, you know, you hear stuff about, you know, about disguising coverages and things because, you know, he knows when you're going to come down and, you know, play a certain coverage when you're disguising and things like that. It just, it helped me to a different standard as far as, you know, how I have to be to a next level when it comes to the mental part of the game.
All right, so you've got Detroit coming up on Monday night. Obviously, you're familiar with Matthew Stafford. When you think about Stafford, you think about that great arm strength. We know this. Right. But you've talked about his athleticism. Do you think he gets enough credit for the athlete, for being the athlete he is?
No, you know, I think that's not a, you know, a thing that's talked about a lot. But, you know, I know playing against him over the years, he makes those scramble plays that, you know, he breaking tackles and getting those first downs on them long third down situations that really, you know, aggravates a secondary and a defense, you know, that's extending plays and extending drives.
Now, a few weeks back, you hosted a bowling event to raise money for the Adrian Amos I'm Still Here Foundation, which benefits Alzheimer's awareness and research. I know it's a cause that means a lot to you. What kind of an impact has that had on you and your family?
Oh man, you just see somebody that's, you know, like the, you know, the pillar of the family that that's always been a strong one and everything. And my grandmother, who, you know, has taken care of everybody, and then you see the shift that, you know, we have to take care of her, and the toll that it takes on the family, that, you know, the changes that happen, because it happens. It almost seems like it happens overnight when, you know, she loses her, you know, her ability to, you know, really, you know, function everyday processes as, you know, on her own, just as far as you have to help her, you know, brush her teeth in the morning and eat. So I just see the effect that it has on our family. So I know, you know, a lot of others are going through the same situation. So, you know, and I feel like I have the platform and the opportunities to help with that.
Adrian, one quick follow. In your situation, you know, for you to be where you are right now takes so much focus and so much attention, and I would imagine those around you understand this, that we have to let him do what he has to do, but you're also a guy that's going to lead from the front. So when you deal with this issue with your family and your grandmother, do you say to those around you, put it on me, put it on my shoulders, I want that? How do you approach it?
I think, you know, my family does a great job of, you know, they don't put too much, you know, pressure, you know, on me to do things like that. That's something that I want to do. Me and my grandma have always been close. So, you know, sometimes I maybe put too much on myself, you know, and they try to help steer me from that, doing that, you know, trying to put everything on myself because, you know, as being in the National Football League, this is a everyday grind. So, you know, we have a lot to do. So they try to, you know, at times, you know, to my not liking, they, you know, keep stuff away from me sometimes because, you know, they know I try to solve everything.
That's exactly what I was getting at. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
It's good family.
Yeah.
Adrian Amos, my guest, Green Bay Packers safety. They're 4-1 on the season, first place in the NFC North and a big game Monday night. Adrian, great to have you on the show. Really nice to talk to you for the first time. Good luck. Hope we can do it again soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
All right, so in case you missed it on Monday, I did spend a part of the program talking about how Snoop Dogg showed up in Lawrence, Kansas to perform at KU's annual event, Late Night in the Fog. Quick reset to get everybody on the same page. Every year, KU ushers in the men's and women's basketball seasons with an event at Allen Fieldhouse called Late Night in the Fog. The description on the university's website says it best. Late Night in the Fog is described on their own website as follows. Quote, Late Night in the Fog is the official kickoff to the basketball season. It's one part scrimmage, one part talent show, and two parts shenanigans. End quote. Ask me? That's a recipe for some serious tomfoolery, if I've ever heard one. Anytime you double up on shenanigans, you know hijinks and horseplay are sure to follow. Hell, you double down on shenanigans, there might even be some monkey business or buffoonery or even an actual barrel of monkeys or more tomfoolery. Man, you never know what with all the shenanigans. I just know this. Any cocktail that has two parts shenanigans is sure to induce a raucous good time. And that's not poppycock either. I mean, I mean it. So the issue at hand is that Snoop Dogg spiked the family-friendly punch because Snoop Dogg went Snoop Dogg and rolled out with his money gun, even with counterfeit money, but a money gun nonetheless. Real stripper poles and a whole lot of language that your kids are not supposed to hear. Now, let's not get this twisted. Snoop did not show up in Lawrence and crash a sock hop. He was invited. He was booked. They brought him in. He was paid. And he did everything that anybody who knows Snoop would expect Snoop to do. And everybody loved it, except the brass at KU. And then they issued a pretty hilarious, albeit misguided, statement apologizing for the program. It was like the equivalent of pulling the pin on a grenade and then being utterly shocked and appalled when it explodes. Snoop had not said anything about it since and didn't really need to. Again, this is Snoop doing Snoop things. You bring in Snoop, you get Snoop. But yesterday, he went on Howard Stern's radio program and Howard asked him about the show at KU. And then Snoop offered the following apology. Let me quote. Snoop said to Howard Stern, quote, to the distinguished faculty and staff and student body of Kansas, I would like to sincerely apologize for my adult theme performance on campus. I deeply regret my actions, and I should have listened when school officials told my management team to keep it clean. End quote. Psych!
Psych.
Yeah, KU wishes he said that, but that's not what he said. Obviously. Instead, he said what I said on Monday. These are actually Snoop's real words on Stern's program. Quote, "When you pay for Snoop Dogg, you're going to get Snoop Dogg. I had the time of my life. I enjoyed myself. I hung out with the basketball teams. They had to cover it up, and I respect them. And I wasn't going to put no smut on their name or say that they did anything wrong because they invited me to come do what I do. The audience enjoyed that bleep. I don't know what the bleep KU is talking about." End quote. In case you're having a hard time following that, let me translate that for you. In other words,
I'd like to take this chance to apologize to absolutely nobody. The double champ does what the f*** he wants.
Snoop does what the bleep he wants. And what he wants is to be himself. And himself is exactly what KU got and what they should have known they were going to get with Snoop when they booked Snoop. I love the part where he said he had the time of his life and that he was not going to smear them for covering up what happened. Like, yo, man, I'm good. I'm so good that I'm not even going to drag you for trying to drag me. And don't worry, Snoop. I already did that on Monday when I suggested that they Google you next time prior to booking you, or instead just go find Will Smith and stop chasing an alleged lack of institutional control with a blatant lack of shenanigan control. So KU's tripping. They're releasing apologies and statements about not knowing that acrobatic dancers meant stripper poles. In the meantime, Snoop is chilling on the Stern Show, sipping gin and juice, saying that he had the time of his life and that he does not know exactly what the bleep KU was talking about. I would tell KU to look up at the scoreboard, but they already know what it says. Snoop won, KU negative infinity. Don't book Snoop and then freak out when Snoop goes Snoop. Listen, if you're anything like me, you're always looking for a better, faster, cleaner source of natural energy and nutrition. I get that. In fact, I've done the research on that. And here's what I came up with. Athletic Greens Ultimate Daily is the obsessively researched, all-in-one nutritional support powder, which contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food ingredients. Let me tell you what you get in one scoop. Just one scoop contains essential prebiotics, probiotics, digestive enzymes, and more, all of which are going to give you the support you need for your gut health, your energy levels, and your immune system. It's so easy, too. Every morning before breakfast, I just mix in a scoop into 10 ounces of water, and I get a jump start on feeling my best the entire day. I feel great. Then, when I'm on the road and away from home, the travel packs make it especially easy to keep up that same healthy routine. Simply put, Athletic Greens can help you feel great every single day, no matter what life throws at you. No compromises, no harmful chemicals, no artificial colors, no sweeteners, no added sugar, no GMOs. Athletic Greens Ultimate Dailies are also gluten and dairy-free. They're vegan, paleo, and keto-friendly, too. So start every single day by squaring away your nutritional needs so you're ready for whatever comes your way. And right now, you can jump on over to athleticgreens.com/Rome. Claim my special offer. 20 free travel packs valued at $79 with your first purchase. That's athleticgreens.com/Rome. Make a note of that. The product is great. athleticgreens.com/Rome. Athletic Greens. Start your day right. Good things will follow. Tom Verducci. Tom, it's great to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim.
Thank you very much. Good to have you. Tom, there are plenty of topics to hit on today, but why don't we start with Game 4 of the Astros and the Rays. As you've written, after Houston lost Game 3, Justin Verlander told A.J. Hinch he won the ball for Game 4. So, Tom, there's been some second-guessing of that decision, but in reality, when you have Justin Verlander asking for the ball, is there any way you say no, especially when the other option is giving it to a rookie?
Yeah, exactly. You put it well. It's exactly. There is no other option. Justin went to A.J. Hinch in the course of Zach Greinke letting Game 3 get away and basically said in so many words, give me the ball. And there's no way you say no to him. He's your best option anyway. And you're right. The other option was trusting a rookie to go out there and having Verlander behind him in relief, which you don't want to do. He's not comfortable doing that. So, listen, I know it's an easy second guess, as Justin said after the game. The low-hanging fruit, blame that game entirely on short rest. He told you himself that he just did. He had no slider last night. I mean, that thing was just spinning. It wasn't moving. And he throws Tommy Pham a changeup, a two-strike changeup. He's thrown 18 of those all year to right-handed hitters. So that's his fourth best pitch. But he went to it because he had no slider. So it was a cascade of events that in terms of his pitch selection that worked against him, all from the fact that he just didn't have any kind of tilt on his slider. So blame it on bad stuff, not 3 days.
Tom Verducci joining us. So obviously, Tom, the Rays' bats break out in a big way. In fact, how different do the Rays look and feel at the plate right now versus how they looked against Verlander and Gerrit Cole in games 1 and 2?
Yeah, listen to me. I don't get involved much in this whole, you know, the narrative, the psycho babble of who's the pressure on, who's the pressure off. What I look at is the confidence level, right? And now you've got a Rays team going game 5 where I'm saying 1 through 9 in that lineup, there's a whole load of confidence with every one of those hitters. That's a different take than where we are at in games 1 and 2. Getting back home definitely helped them, but seeing Greinke with bad stuff and Verlander with bad stuff, got all these guys feeling really good at the plate right now. So that, to me, is why I look at Tampa Bay now as a very dangerous team. I mean, if you just break down the numbers, Houston's a much better offensive team than Tampa Bay. We know that. But right now, when you look at confidence level of the hitters, Tampa Bay has the better lineup.
Tom Verducci is joining us. Wow. All right, so what about this? I mean, after being pretty quiet in Tampa Bay, do you expect Houston's bats to wake up when they get back home? What do you expect from them?
Listen, not against Tyler Glasnow. I mean, the one thing about Tampa Bay, Jim, it's like if anybody ever gave you for a holiday gift that 110-piece socket wrench set, right?
Right.
That tool for every job and everything you need to solve, that's Tampa Bay's pitching staff. So there's nobody on their staff who throws with average stuff or even conventionally in the way they deliver the baseball. So tonight you're going to get Glasnow throwing upper 90s. With the longest extension in all of Major League Baseball. You watch him get down that mound, it looks like he's going to hand the ball to the catcher, not throw it to him. So one after one, the Tampa Bays, and you've seen this throughout the series, they're bringing in guys who throw the ball unconventionally and or with elite stuff. Glasnow happens to have elite stuff and be unconventional. So, yeah, when you ask me if they're going to wake up, I think they'll have better at-bats, but I am not looking for a slugfest tonight at all.
Tom Verducci is joining us. All right, Tom, before we get to Game 5 tomorrow, we've got a couple of Game 5s in the National League today. First up, you've got St. Louis and Atlanta. What do you make of how that series has played out so far, and what are your thoughts about that game?
Well, first of all, Jim, I got to tell you, this is one of the most underrated days on a sports calendar. We have two elimination games, two baseball sudden-death games on the same day. We haven't had that in 4 years. It happens very rarely. You know, the wild card games are split on different days. We have two game fives and two series that have been back and forth, terrific, well-played games. So, you know, to me, the one that jumps out is Strasburg against Buehler. I mean, that I think the first team to get the two may win that game. You know, when I look at Strasburg, I mean, his stuff is just off the charts, but it's been really good the last month or two. And I think to beat the Dodgers, he's exactly the kind of pitcher you want. I know you want to neutralize the left-handed hitters in their lineup, but he does that as a right-handed pitcher with that great changeup that he has. And Buehler, to me, he was my pick before this postseason to be at the end of it all, at the last game of the World Series. I thought he would be the one guy we're talking about as the guy who kind of dominated the postseason. He's got the opportunity in front of him. And if you know anything about Walker, if you asked him if he wanted this ball, how he could draw it up, he would want the ball in his hands for a decisive game. I mean, he loves these moments. He's got the stuff to get through it. But, yeah, that's another game I'm looking at really close. And the thing to watch is both of these games, Jim, National League games, these series where they've been close, to me the pivot point is always the third at-bat for the starting pitcher, right? In the American League, that's not an issue with the DH. National League, you've got your stud on the mound. He's throwing the ball well, but that's decision point. That's the pressure point for the manager. When do you hit for Buehler? When do you hit for Strasburg? General rule of thumb is if your team is behind for that starting pitcher's third at bat, you have to hit for him. I mean, that's tough to take those guys out of the game if you're talking about a 1-0 game. So to me, that's the thing to look for and to tell everybody, if you're one of these people in favor of universal DH think back to some of the best postseason games you ever saw. Most of them are played under National League rules. I mean, the game is getting a little more, I want to say, more like checkers than chess anyway, the way it's played, with very few people running, balls not in play. At least keep us with the strategy here in this game, because if you have that pitcher spot in the lineup, there's so many layers to the pressures that managers have to face. So to me, I look at tonight, third time at bat for the starting pitcher. What do the managers do?
I think that is such an interesting point that you make, you know, Tom. Tom Verducci, my guest. I would say it may depend in part about that bullpen, but, like, for instance, everybody knows about Scherzer and Strasburg and how good they are. But at the same time, Tom, how do you explain the fact that a team with the worst bullpen of all 450 teams to make the postseason has a chance to advance with a win tonight? How does that work?
It's hard to do. I wouldn't recommend what the Nationals have done. I feel a little bit bad for Davey Martinez because he's got so few choices, and that's why you've seen Corbin and Scherzer pitching out of the bullpen in this series. And I would go back to Corbin if I had to out of the pen in this game. Listen, if you're Davey Martinez, you basically want no more than three people touching the ball on the mound today, and that's Strasburg, Hudson, and Doolittle. And I don't think you'll see anybody else taking the ball. If it is, it'll be Corbin for a batter or two. That really ties the hands of the manager. He's not going to play matchup. He just can't go through a lot of relief pitching the way a lot of managers do in today's game. It's just very shallow. So when you talk about that ERA, Jim, a lot of those numbers are from people you're not going to see in any kind of a leverage situation, especially tonight, but throughout a postseason series. But it is a very shallow bullpen.
We have Tom Verducci for a few more moments. Tom, you had a great piece on Walker Buehler for Sports Illustrated back in August, and he's got this great personality. And to illustrate that, there's also a great story about how he called David Fries a piece of trash when he first met him. Buehler talks a lot of junk to guys in his own clubhouse about how strong he is, about how hard he throws, about how good he is at cards, and on and on and on. What's your sense as to how the guys in that clubhouse respond to all of that?
Yeah, they love him. I think it says a lot, A, about his talent, but more so, B, his personality. He's an extremely hard worker. Those guys on that team will tell you pound for pound, Walker Buehler is the strongest guy in the Dodgers. And you'll watch the game tonight, you look at that guy in his uniform, and you think I'm joking. That can't possibly be true. But, I mean, he throws some really heavy loads of iron around that weight room, and he gets after it. So he gets respect from his work ethic as well. It's a very interesting dynamic when you're talking about a young player who can essentially talk trash, and he does it in such a way that it's endearing to teammates. It doesn't put them off at all. There's no resentment at all. It's something special about this kid. I think he's got a gift for throwing a baseball. The spin rate, if you're into that stuff, on four or five different pitches is elite. He can beat you with the fastball alone sometimes, but he got so many weapons, he never has to do that. But I think the fact that he's such a hard worker and is a real team player, I think the fact he can be so, if you want to call him cocky, arrogant, whatever, I think that's in a good way. The teammates would all tell you that nobody resents him for it.
So final thought then, all these things are positive things, and you want that guy to have that ball because he wants the ball. But again, he's only 25. He's only in his second full season. He's in a must-win game, and the spotlight could be too bright for a lot of young guys. Is any part of you worried about how he'll handle the pressure?
I would have been last year, Jim, but if you remember, he had that game in Atlanta where he could not find the plate. He walked the other pitcher. He had bases loaded. I mean, it was a very ugly inning. The game essentially got away from him early. I think it was the second inning, but he put the wheels back on the bus and actually gave them a decent outing, I think five innings. And I know that he learned from that experience. And watching him pitch that first time against Washington showed me another thing. He got into some situations where he got behind on counts, and he never gave in to a hitter. He was more than willing to throw a nasty pitch off the plate. And if he didn't get the chase swing, he was okay with walking the guy and go attack the next hitter. That really impressed me, the way that, especially pitching to Rendon and Soto, I never saw him give in at all. And again, he's a guy who can walk you and still go get the next guy. That's not going to bother him. So that, to me, showed me a level of maturity on the mound, especially the game last year at Atlanta and the one this year, first game against Washington, that, no, I wouldn't be worried about him handling the moment.
You want to make sure you watch him on Fox Sports, MLB Network, and remember, you can watch Tom Verducci on Fox Sports' coverage of the ALCS, plus MLB Network is airing live pre- and post-game coverage before and after every postseason game. Tom, as you mentioned, this is one of the best sports days of the year. Great to have you on to talk about it. Thank you very much for breaking that down, Tom.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks.
Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Hey, Jimmy, thanks for the Vine. I've heard a lot of, if you want to ask the pros, what was the best call you ever heard? I would say, without a doubt, when Terrence and Sierra Madre broke out like some whiskey jug, he welcomed a Kentucky affiliate. I mean, that was before reading was allowed, before, I think that was on a zero tolerance Friday. Still the best caller to ever not win a smack off, Terrence and Sierra Madre. The only reason I even bring it up is because we know he's good at least a couple years back when he showed up for the smack off. So anyway, in my opinion, if you want to play that for the decades of people that have never heard that call, it will blow people's minds. There's no way that he didn't script that, and he didn't. It was just off the cuff.
Let me tell you something, Dan. I want to compliment you because what you just did was Adam Hawk's job, and you did it better than he does it. Now, there is one problem with that. You just said, I got your ATP right here, Rome. Since you can't find one, or Hawk can't find one, I got your ATP right here. I've said it a million times. The ATP feeds into a specific address. You can't tweet your ATP, you can't email your ATP, and you can't verbally ask your ATP on the phones. The ATP must be posed in the form of a question at cbssportsradio.com/askthepros. Now, he also just said, hey, Rome, why don't you play that call for those who've never heard the call, because that's the best call. But he then first asked me, what do you think, Rome? What's the best call you've ever heard? This was a very good call. Now, keep in mind, place and time. If I play this call in 2019, it'll hold up fine. But you're not going to hear me like, damn, that's the best call to a radio show I've ever heard. But if you heard it when he made it in its proper context, you would say that's one of the best calls at that time. Terrence welcomed Martinsburg as only Terrence could back in the day.
Finally, Rome, I'd like to apologize to the good people of Martinsburg for my jungle brethren's rude and apparently inaccurate remarks depicting you people as a bunch of rednecks. I'm sure if they'd known that Martinsburg was actually a suburb of Washington, D.C., and not some hillbilly paradise, they wouldn't have said those mean things. Anyways, I'd like to make it up to you next, sophisticated suburbanites. Rome, I was wondering if I could get some theme music. You know that music those necks, Washington insiders like. That's it. Howdy, Martinsburg. Now, I don't give a possum's ass how close you are to Baltimore. You all bunch of toothless, barefoot, cold-digging hillbilly rednecks. Yeehaw! I love that riff. And are you next coming in the jungle? I'm going to play along on my jug. Welcome to the jungle, Martinsburg. Hey, and get your lazy hillbilly ass back down the mine shaft to dig some more coal. It's hot, and I'm not turning my air conditioner off till the end of October. That's all I got to say. Yeehaw!
Pete Prisco, good to have you back. Pete, how are you?
Good, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. Pete, appreciate the visit. Go ahead and humor me here, Pete. The Giants are going to face the Patriots tomorrow night. Weird things happen on Thursday nights, but is there any way this Giants team can beat this Patriots team tomorrow?
No, absolutely not. And look, the bottom line is, even if they had all their weapons, it would be a tough challenge for a rookie quarterback against Belichick and that defense. And this might be the best defense Belichick has had. And that's saying something, because I know you go back to all those defenses when, you know, Ty Law and Teddy Bruschi and Willie McGinnis. But this secondary is playing unbelievably good football. And I'm talking about across the board, all of them. You know, as good as Gilmore been in his career, Jason McCourty might be playing better than him this year. And Devin McCourty's outstanding. And the young corners are all playing well. So I think this is going to be a real challenge for Daniel Jones. You know, when he doesn't have Barkley, he doesn't have Ingram, it's going to even be a bigger challenge. So no, they have no chance to win that game.
Pete Prisco joining us. You know, it's an amazing statement you make about their defense. They've had some really good defenses, and this might be their best. At the same time, you tweeted recently, quote, Brady looks like crap the past 2 weeks. What are the things, Pete, that jump out to you in particular that make you think that right now, anyway, he looks like crap?
Well, he got it going after I sent that tweet out, so maybe I motivated him, Jim. But seriously, he struggled a little bit, you know, and I think some of that has to do with the protection. The protection hasn't been great. And we know through the years, no matter who plays on that line, Dante Scarnecchia always seems to fix it. Well, so far they haven't fixed it yet. So he's getting hit a little more. He's getting the ball out quicker. He's not as patient as he's been in the past. And I think in the second half of that game last week, he seemed to pick it up a little bit. And look, I'm not one of those guys that buried him after the Chiefs game a couple years ago like a lot of people did, said he's done and finished. He just hasn't looked as crisp as he has at times in the past. And you know what? Last year he wasn't great during the regular season either, but he picks it up toward the end of the year and on into the postseason.
Pete Prisco is joining us. Do you think it's only a matter of time before that offense gets rolling, or might this season be different?
Well, I think it'll get rolling once they get the line working, you know, as a unit. Not having Gronk hurts them. Edelman's not 100%. They haven't really adapted yet to not having Gronk, and I think that's a challenge for them. They haven't run the ball. Sony Michel's been hurt. So there's been a lot of injuries and a lot of factors. And again, most of the time the Patriots gear everything they do to December, everything. And usually the defense takes a long time to get going, and that's what's so impressive about this group. It hasn't taken time. I think the offense will take time, but by December they'll be fine.
Pete Prisco is joining us. All right, Pete, moving along. How impressed were you with what San Francisco did Monday night against the Browns?
Very. And look, their offensive line dominated up front. They ran the ball. They did whatever they want. And that whole offense is predicated on that zone running scheme. If you can get it running, then I think it's going to make a lot easier for Jimmy Garoppolo. But the other side of the ball, that down defensive group just dominated. I thought they would. The Browns have major issues on the offensive line. You know, all offseason, all anybody talks about, look at all the weapons they have. Oh, my gosh, they're going to be so explosive. Everybody lost sight of the fact that the line was an issue. I mean, Greg Robinson was a reject at one point in his career, and now he's a starting left tackle. The right guard situation isn't great. Hubbard's a solid player, but not a great player at right tackle. And I think that's showing up in a big way, and it's impacting Baker Mayfield.
Pete Prisco is joining us. I'm going to go back to the Browns in a minute, Pete. But in terms of the Niners, they follow up that huge game on Monday night with arguably even a bigger game against the Rams on Sunday. How do you think the Niners will show up in that game on a short week?
You know, it's interesting. When you watch the Rams' lines, their offensive line has had some problems, and their defensive line is little. You know, Aaron Donald is a big guy. He's a dominant player, but the guys around the blockers is pretty big, but the rest of those guys are little. Teams can run on them, and they've been run on. And if I'm the Rams this week, I'm very concerned about that because, you know, this Niners team is going to go in there and try and run the ball with whoever's back there, Coleman, Breida, whoever. So that's a concern, and I love the pass rush. So I think this is a good setup for the Niners. Other than the fact that the Rams have been off since, you know, they'll have 10 days off, and you're playing on a short week. That's a problem usually for teams.
I think you're right, and I think the Rams need that time off after dropping back-to-back games to Tampa Bay and Seattle. Now, going back to Cleveland, they're coming off a tough loss at San Francisco, and they've got to face Seattle next, but you've called your shot. You're predicting a Browns win. What do you see that makes you feel that way?
I just think they're going to regroup. And look, the Seattle pass rush was better last week against the Rams. It hasn't been great all year, even with Clowney. And usually the team that doesn't have the great pass rush isn't going to impact Baker Mayfield the way that the 49ers did. So I think he's going to have some opportunities. I also think this is a game Beckham gets right. You know, I've been saying that for a couple weeks. I thought 2 weeks ago he would get it, and he didn't catch any pass against Baltimore. And then last week he was almost a no-show. I think this is a game for Beckham. And I think they'll get some guys back on defense, which will help. And for me, it's a long trip to the East Coast, and I just think this is an upset in the waiting for the Cleveland Browns.
Pete Prisco back in the jungle breaking it all down. You know, Pete, you could pretty easily argue, I think, that the NFC West for the moment is the best division in football. So when you look at San Francisco, Seattle, and Los Angeles, who is the best team in that division?
I still think the Rams will figure it out and be the best team. I just think that the way Sean McVay calls plays and the offense hasn't quite clicked as well. Gurley hasn't done it. We saw glimpses of it last week, though. You saw him score 2 touchdowns, got off to a fast start. I think the Rams will end up being the best team. The corners haven't played well either, particularly Tlaib. He struggled a little bit. I think that's shown up in a big way. But I think the Rams will figure it out. They'll end up being the best team.
Now, Pete, in your preview of Philadelphia at Minnesota, you wrote, quote, Is this a big game? It seems like it. That's not good news for Kirk Cousins, end quote. I mean, it's kind of harsh, but it's fair, right? Why do you think that Kirk Cousins struggles the way he in big games?
You know, so that has to be something inside of him. And, you know, nobody can put a finger on it other than Kirk Cousins. And, you know, you talk to people up there, does the moment get too big for him? Who knows? But they're trying to figure it out themselves. But the history says that's exactly what happened in his past. And until he proves everybody wrong, it's always going to be out there. And I think a couple weeks ago he struggled. He called it, you know, everybody got called out in the passing game and they responded to it. But now you're at home. You're playing an Eagles team that went on the road the last time and beat the Packers, who have a good defense. So it's up to you. You got to go out there and make plays. But I have my doubts about it. Until he wins them, I'm seriously going to have my doubts about him in big games.
We're talking to Pete Prisco for a few more moments. Pete, let me ask you about Kansas City. They're coming off a tough loss to Indy on Sunday night. Patrick Mahomes is a little bit banged up at the moment. How has Kansas City's offense looked to you in their last two games?
Unsettled. And I think some of that has to do with the injuries. They lost Watkins early in that game the other night. The offensive line lost the left guard later in the game, but they've been playing without the left tackle, Fisher. And so he got dinged up, Patrick Mahomes. And he's different when he's not moving around, creating all those problems outside the pocket. And so they got handled last week. And I give the Colts a lot of credit. That was not a good look for the Kansas City Chiefs. But, again, they haven't had Tyreek Hill. Teams are doubling Kelce all over the place, and they didn't have Watkins last week. They get those guys back healthy, and he gets healthy. There's going to be the same explosive offense. And this week, that should be a shootout with the Texans. That'll be a fun game to watch.
Pete Prisco joining me for a couple of more moments. Pete, a couple of quick things before you go. The Redskins get rid of Jay Gruden, and they want to make sure that everybody knows that the culture there is, quote, actually damn good. Pete, does it feel to you like Gruden was the problem, and now that he's gone, everything's going to be smooth sailing for the Redskins? Is that how it feels?
Absolutely not. You know, Dan Snyder's had so many coaches in his career, and he's won one playoff game. That, you know, you got to point the finger at the owner. You got to point the finger at Bruce Allen. And the culture is something that's a fun. We love to throw that word out there, and they do it too. But what is culture? When you're winning, your culture's great. When you're losing, your culture's garbage. That's basically the bottom line. And there have been teams that have won that had bad cultures, but they were so good they overcame it. I don't buy any of that. I don't think it's a culture issue. I think it's an ownership/president issue, and until they fix that, it's going to be a problem no matter who coaches that team.
Right. I want to ask you about a guy before I go that I always liked, and I know you respect him, but let me set it up this way. Daniel Jeremiah recently compared Dalvin Cook to Priest Holmes, and then that inspired a Twitter discussion about former NFL running backs, and the name Fred Taylor comes up. You covered Fred back in the day. For those who don't remember, how big, how fast, how skilled was Fred Taylor?
Fred Taylor was one of those rare players that come around once in a blue moon. And that's why the players themselves always respected Fred more than the fans did. You know, fans always put that thing on there, fragile Fred. He wasn't fragile Fred. He missed some time. Hey, Jim, he had a muscle torn off the bone in a game. It was like he was shot with a rifle from the stands, and he dropped the ball, fumbled, and Coughlin listed him week to week every week. That's where the fragile Fred stuff came in. He's 6'2". Weighed about 232, 233, 234 pounds, and ran 4.243. He could run away from people. He made people miss. He should be in the Hall of Fame. He doesn't get nearly the consideration he deserves.
Why is that, Pete? I mean, and the guy was so strong, and he was so good. And I can remember even you, me, those who knew would fight that good fight on his behalf at that time. Why does Fred Taylor not get the respect that he deserves?
Well, part of it is because he played in Jacksonville, I think, and that hurts him. It hurts, you know, a lot of the guys there. But again, I think it's the fragile Fred moniker, which, you know, if you do your work on him, it's not true. Look, he averaged 4.5 yards per carry, I think, in seven seasons. You know, Curtis Martin did it once. And you know, that's, I'm not knocking Curtis Martin. He should be in the Hall of Fame, but it's special. When you watch Fred Taylor, anytime anybody wants to argue with me about Fred Taylor, go pop on some of his plays, and you tell me that's not a special running back who should be in the Hall of Fame.
And Martin, and rightfully so, but Martin is beloved, right? And Fred Taylor just can't get that respect. I agree with you. Last thought, you got Washington, Pete, against Miami Sunday, a battle of two of the worst teams in the NFL. If you had to pick a winner there, who do you have?
Miami. I think this is a bad spot for the Redskins. Changing coaches. You know, he's going to start Keenum at quarterback, but that's okay. I just think that Miami's sitting there coming off the bye. It's going to be hot. We know how that plays out in South Florida. It's going to be hot for them. I think this is a good spot. Miami plays hard. They're not talented, but they play hard. I wonder if the Redskins will with Bill Callahan. I like Miami to win the game.
Senior NFL columnist for CBSSports.com. He is an analyst on the Pick 6 podcast. And as I mentioned, a good friend of the program. Pete, great to have you back. Thank you so much.
Anytime, Jim. You know that.
Jock in Quebec. I love it. Jock, what's going on?
Hey, bonjour, Monsieur Jim Rome.
Bonjour, Jacques.
Jacques. My name is Jacques.
Oh, Jacques.
And I call you first. Yeah, I call you first time. Call you first time. I come from Latouk. Latouk is side by side Montreal, and I love that they own the Tampa Bay. The Tampa Bay Rays own les them. We like them. We're gonna be World Series champion. We're gonna be the champion of the world. Yeah, me. And Gary Carter and Al Oliver and Larry Walker and Jackie Robinson and Pete Rose and Greg Nettles and Celine Dion. We're going to be the best in the world. And you come to my place, we're going to have a big party. And I take you, me and my friends, we're going to go to the tavern and we're going to buy you lots of Quebec beer.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
I knew there was something going on when he corrected me and said, I'm not Jock, I'm Jacques. Are we going to really go to the tavern, Jacques? Let's go to Southfield. Jeff in Southfield. Jeff, what's going on?
Thanks for the fine, Jim. Jim, after the recent Green Bay clone stock, Kyler Green Bay tweeted, and I quote, I'm not really a clone like you losers. I hardly listen to the show anymore. I just know how to use the show to my advantage. It's called marketing, end quote. Hey, Kyle, if you're just using the show to market yourself, then let us help you with that. Hey, brides-to-be, do you want your wedding videotaped by a guy who's known for calling national radio shows to brag about his trip to the strip club? Then you want Kyle and Green Bay videography. When you call Kyle, you get more than just a videographer. You get the videographer who thinks approaching married couples and saying, your husband's a loser, is a strong alpha move. Yes, with Kyle in Green Bay, your video might get titled, Jumpman Gillette Wedding, because, oh man, he's nervous. But don't worry, Kyle will calm those nerves by getting good and liquored up. And soon enough, Kyle will be insisting that your wedding party ain't no party until someone's drunk ass has been tossed onto a table like it was a Bills game. But that's not all you get with Kyle and Green Bay videography. With Kyle, you also get the guy who doesn't just know to wear a suit to your wedding. You have to ask him. And if you don't, he's showing up in the cheap-ass Kyle and Green Bay embroidered polo shirt that he ordered from his Uline catalog. If you want to contact Kyle, go to his Twitter. He's the guy in his avatar standing on the roof of a car with a beer in his hand and a sloppy ass wasted look on his face. Yes, that's Kyle in Green Bay videography, run by Kyle, a guy who's still chasing that wild teenage party in his late 20s. Hey, Kyle, I'm not seeing the wisdom in your marketing strategy, bro. May I suggest replacing it with one that involves growing the hell up? Just saying.
Jeff in Southfield calling up to talk about Kyle in Green Bay's marketing strategy. I got to be honest. I didn't know that Kyle was a videographer.
Good night,